Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Whether you're gifting, decorating, or treating yourself, Lowe's December Deal Drops are here to help you save more all month long. Get up to 50% off select holiday decor. Plus, get up to 45% off select tools and accessories. Shop new December Deal Drops every week this month and get so much more out of your holidays. Lowe's, we help you save. Selection varies by location while supplies last.
Okay, let's read all about this from Anne Curry, who gives us way more detail than either Sir Winston or Sir Charles. She tells us this, quote, "He may initially have contemplated continuing the campaign." We're back in 1415, by the way, now, talking about Henry, that he may have initially contemplated continuing the campaign. "That was the impression he wanted to give to the Parliament, which opened on the 4th of November, 1415, while he was still absent in France. The Chancellor's opening speech reported his successes at Harfleur and Agincourt. Quote, "Praise be to God with the highest honour and gain which the realm has ever had in so short a time," quote. But warned that without further financial assistance, this, quote, "propitious, honourable and profitable expedition," quote, could not continue. The Lords and Commons were invited to consider how provision could be made in this matter, such as will be suitable for the completion and continuation of the expedition, quote. Whether Henry really was considering prolonging the campaign, perhaps with an attack on the Burgundian-held stronghold at Ardres on the edge of the Calais marches, seems unlikely. If so, he appears to have been dissuaded by his leading captains. More likely, the king was worried about his financial resources more generally and felt that Parliament would be more likely to vote him another tax if it believed he wanted to continue in arms. And so it turned out. After the instalment of the lay subsidy, scheduled for payment in February 1416, had been brought forward to December 1415, a new subsidy had been granted for November 1416, and the king had been awarded the trade taxes for life. He announced the campaign completed and brought his army home. Parliament closed on the 13th of November. 3 days later, Henry landed in England. On the 23rd of November, he entered London in triumph, with the citizens arranging and paying for a series of tableaux in his honour and also theirs to emphasise the status of the city itself and their own prestige. At the end of London Bridge, the giants Gog and Magog, traditional guardians of the city, were dressed in all their finery, bent upon seeing the eagerly awaited face of their lord and welcoming him with abundant praise. Quote, "En route, the king was greeted by choirs and heraldic display. The tower of the water conduit at Cornhill was covered with crimson cloth and decorated with the royal arms, as well as those of St. George, St. Edward the Confessor, and St. Edmund. As the king passed it, quote, a company of prophets, quote, with white hair, golden capes, and turbans released, quote, as an acceptable sacrifice to God for the victory, end quote. Sparrows and other small birds, some descended onto the king's breast, some settled upon his shoulders, and some circled around him in twisting flight, while the prophets chanted, sing to the Lord a new song, hallelujah. At the Cheapside Cross, a choir of beautiful young maidens adorned in white sang, welcome Henry ye Fifth, King of England and of France, as if to another David coming from the slaying of Goliath, who might appropriately be represented by the arrogant French. This was not a Roman-style triumph, however. The king was accompanied not by his whole army, but by a small retinue, and only the six most important prisoners were paraded. Onlookers were struck by the king's humble demeanour. which underlined his constant emphasis on the God-given nature of his victory. The procession culminated in religious devotion at Westminster Abbey. All mention of Agincourt after the event was consciously linked to God's support for the king. The idea of God-given victory was not new, but Henry pushed it to new heights as part of his vision of kingship. It was also fanned by his advisers, at least one of whom, notwithstanding the king's self-conscious projection of humility, was worried that the victory would go to the king's head. And this is what he wrote at the time. The royal majesty deems and firmly holds, as I presume, that not thy hand, but the outstretched hand of God hath done all these things. For his own praise, the honour and glory of the English nation, and the eternal memory of the royal name. Moreover, it is fitting that your royal highness should not boast of the past, but be anxious for the future. Neither let the power of our enemies drag us back, nor let their astuteness disturb us, nor let any fair promises seduce anyone. End quote. So, yeah, the idea that you owe this victory to God and, you know, don't forget it. That is definitely true. So don't get a big head. You owe everything to God. And Curry continues. The author of these words was very probably Henry's uncle and chancellor, Henry Beaufort. If so, they were perhaps written with Henry's behaviour as prince as well as king in mind. But if the implication of these words was that Agincourt provided a decisive advantage in terms of Anglo-French politics, it did not prove to be the case. Indeed, rather than respond to the crushing defeat with diplomatic efforts to come to terms, the French aimed to strike back as fast as possible with an attempt to recover Harfleur. The English conquest was proving very difficult to sustain, especially in terms of supplying food to the garrison there. Indeed, increasingly desperate sorties in March 1416 had ended in near disaster with losses of both men and horses. By early April, the French had laid a naval blockade against the town and had established garrisons on the landward side. The Earl of Dorset, who had been appointed captain of Harfleur at its surrender, was at the end of his tether by the middle of the month. He had written to the Royal Council on several occasions for food, artillery and other items, but he noted in a strongly worded dispatch, quote, "Nothing has been provided, which was extremely disappointing to myself and the loyal subjects of the king. If meat is not sent as soon as possible, we will have to return at Whitsun," which is the 7th of June, "and, you know, abandon Harfleur." And Curry continues saying, "Since late January that year, Henry had been drawing up plans to lead another expedition to France, but while Parliament, sitting again throughout March and April 1416, agreed to bring forward to June the subsidy due for payment in November, the problem of Harfleur forced Henry onto the defensive. In late May and early June, an army of 7,500 was raised to save Harfleur. Its ratio of one man at arms to two archers, as opposed to the 1-3 preferred for land campaigns, reflected the intention to use it at sea, where longbowmen were not needed in large numbers. But although Henry had moved to the Southampton area in early July, he did not participate in the naval campaign that followed, which was under the command of his brother John, Duke of Bedford. 2 months earlier, Henry had welcomed Sigismund of Luxembourg, the King of the Germans, whom the English already called Emperor, Holy Roman Emperor, who had arrived in England, keen to broker peace between England and France for the sake of a solution at the Council of Constance to the papal schism. Sigismund's visit was a diplomatic coup for Henry. European rulers rarely deigned to cross the Channel, and he responded in kind, spending lavishly on entertaining his imperial visitor, and on the 24th of May, investing him with the Order of the Garter. It was, apparently, Sigismund who persuaded Henry that it was too dangerous for him and potentially harmful to the common good for the king to risk the perils of the sea in person. At the end of May, Sigismund was joined in England by William, Count of Holland, Zealand and Hainaut, with the idea that both should try to broker a settlement between England and France. But their solution, that Harfleur should be placed in the Emperor's hands, was acceptable neither to Henry, who had added it to the gains made by Edward III at the Treaty of Brittany in 1360, as essential to any peace, or the French, who assumed they would soon retake the town. Accepting failure, Sigismund was willing to enter into a perpetual alliance with Henry, which was sealed at Canterbury on the 15th of August. The very same day, as chance would have it, that the navy led by his brother, John, Duke of Bedford, routed the French at the Battle of the Seine and saved Harfleur for the English. The Treaty of Canterbury recognised Henry's rights against the French and in theory offered imperial support in their implementation, although, as it transpired, the Emperor never would give military aid to Henry. But the treaty was significant simply in its signing. Here was evidence that Henry, based on his successes against the French, was now seen as a serious player in Europe. Equally significant was a meeting brokered by Count William to take place at Calais the following October between Henry and William's brother-in-law, John the Fearless, Duke of Burgundy. What both parties hoped to get out of this meeting and what exactly happened at it remains shrouded in mystery. According to one undated English diplomatic source, Duke John was inclined to support Henry's claim to the French crown. Another, however, reports that when offered by Henry a share in any future French conquests, the Duke refused. It is unlikely that any understanding between Henry and Duke John was reached. Furthermore, Burgundian power in France was uncertain at this point, since the Duke had neither a formal role in government nor any control over the king. Indeed, his purpose in agreeing to a meeting with the English king was simply to remind his internal enemies in France, the Armagnac party, that he could stir up trouble if he felt so inclined. That autumn, it soon became apparent that Henry was bent on a new land campaign in France, with or without Burgundian aid. Although his victories had made the winning of support at home easier, it was by no means guaranteed. Henry still had to engage in the politics of persuasion. At the Parliament, which began at Westminster on the 19th of October, 1416, Chancellor Henry Beaufort's opening speech emphasised not only the King's martial successes in France in 1415, but also his efforts at the Leicester Parliament of 1414 to have law observed within the realm. The speech included the call, quote, "Let us make wars so that we might have peace, for the end of war is peace," quote. A war, therefore, represented firm kingship towards achieving justice at home and abroad. In this, Beaufort reflected how Henry wanted to portray himself as a just and peaceful king. Keen as he was to go to war, he was equally anxious to be seen to avoid shedding Christian blood. Here, then, war was portrayed not as an end in itself, but as a way of bringing, or more accurately forcing, the French to peace. This would, it was implied, be a long campaign, but confidence in a positive outcome was encouraged by a biblical analogy. Reference was made to the fact that this was the king's sixth parliament. As with creation, which came to full fruition on the seventh day, a perfect and early completion was surely at hand. End quote. Anne Curry continues saying, the commons were persuaded and granted a double lay subsidy worth £76,000, three quarters of which they generously agreed could be collected by February 1417. Such an arrangement gave Henry much more cash in hand than he had had for the campaign of 1415, 2 years before, and allowed him to begin raising troops as soon as the money started coming in. But another decision at the Parliament also reveals that there had been some reservations about the credit mechanisms Henry had used for mobilising troops in 1415. Although it was agreed that the current tax income could be used as security for loans, the King had to promise to work hard to repay them. His brothers, Thomas and John, were also placed under obligation to do this should the king die in the meantime. Here Henry revealed himself as a skilled negotiator, willing to compromise in order to achieve his desired outcome, something also seen in his efforts to deal with other financial issues still outstanding from 1415 concerning his use of jewels for the wages of the second quarter of service. The indentures for the Agincourt campaign had committed Henry to redeem the pawned royal jewels within 19 months, that is, by January 1417, which was now only a couple of months away. Meanwhile, on the 19th of November 1416, the day after Parliament ended, a list of those who fought at Agincourt was delivered by Sir Robert Babthorpe, controller of the King's household, to the Exchequer. This surely reflects the view of the nobility that, before indentures for a new campaign were drawn up, the Crown needed to settle its Agincourt debts. Many of Henry's captains had ended up paying soldiers from their own pockets. The King was also asked to answer other unresolved matters. These concerns, in fact, are revealed by a set of council minutes for the 6th of March 1417, in which both the questions and the King's answers are recorded. The fifth question posed to Henry concerns whether those accounting for the men killed at the Battle of Agincourt should have allowed to them the whole of the second quarter or only to the day of their death, end quote. Henry replied that they should be allowed as the others who are now living. In other words, anyone killed at Agincourt was, like the survivors, to be deemed eligible to receive pay for the whole campaign. Therefore, there was no need to record the Agincourt dead in the post-campaign accounting process, and it is why we have an incomplete knowledge of English fatalities. Henry's generous gesture, one useful for a king to make when on the point of recruiting a new army, and one which would also help to renew in people's minds the glory of the victory of 1415. At the end of the Parliament, Thomas Beaufort, who had defended Harfleur so vigorously in the aftermath of its conquest, was promoted from Earl of Dorset to Duke of Exeter, a reminder to the nobility and gentry, if one was needed, of the potential rewards of military service. An aggressively anti-French tone was also present in Parliament's confirmation of Henry's alliance with Sigismund, which, although an act of love on the part of the Emperor, nonetheless showed the French in a bad light and encouraged both the English as well as Sigismund's subjects to take up arms against them. With the country gearing up for war, Henry granted a petition of the Fletchers of the City of London that clogmakers should no longer be permitted to use aspen, since the timber was needed to make arrows, but only on the proviso that, quote, Fletchers throughout the realm sell their arrows at a more moderate and reasonable price in future than they had sold them previously, quote. Henry wanted to prevent producers exploiting what was obviously going to be increased demand for armaments as he prepared for his next campaign in France. Meanwhile, both convocations of clergy in the province of York as well as at Canterbury were equally generous in tax grants. As a result, more money poured into the exchequer in 1416 to 1417 than any other period between 1399 and 1485. In the following months, Henry drew heavily on the glorious memory of Agincourt to ramp up public support for the forthcoming campaign. At his behest, and with the support of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Henry Chicherley, the Canterbury Convocation agreed in December 1416 to a broad programme of commemoration for the 25th of October in the years to come. In the Canterbury province, prayers were to be shared on that day between Crispin and Crispian, whose feast it was. In contrast to the elevation in January of 1416 of the Feast of St. George to the status of a double religious feast, where there was no mention of the battle, the wording of the December 1416 order invoked the battle explicitly. Quote, the gracious victory granted by the mercy of God to the English on the feast of the translation of the saint, St. John of Beverley, to the praise of the divine name and to the honour of the kingdom of England, end quote. Meanwhile, from February 1417 onwards, Henry set about mobilising an army of at least 10,000 men, slightly smaller than his invasion force of 1415, but with similar proportion of men-at-arms and archers, with departure arranged for late July. Henry deliberately chose the date of his landing as the 1st of August, the feast of St. Peter ad Vincula, St. Peter in chains, the notion being that just as the Apostle Peter was freed by an angel from King Herod's captivity, so Henry was liberating the Normans from the shackles of French rule. He was undertaking not simply a campaign of conquest, but also a highly orchestrated recreation of the English Duchy of Normandy, with the King of England as Duke. There had been elements of this in 1415, but nothing to compare with the comprehensiveness of the 1417 programme. The duchy had been in the hands of the French crown for over 200 years, ever since King John had lost it in 1204. In 1259, Henry III had acknowledged its surrender, dropping the title Duke of Normandy, which English kings had held since 1066. Now, in 1417, Henry's programme stressed two things. One was the appeal to Norman separatism. Despite the long tenure by the King of France, the duchy's inhabitants remained suspicious of the power of distant Paris, sentiments that Henry was keen to exploit to his own advantage, offering the Normans their rights and privileges so long as they accepted his rule. The second complementary aspect of his Norman policy was a deliberate invocation of the Anglo-Norman past, reinforcing Normandy's sense of separatism from France and appealing to an English public. A crucial element was the granting of lands in Normandy to his soldiers and administrators as a kind of Norman conquest in reverse. This policy, termed by historians the Lancastrian land settlement, persisted into the 1440s throughout the English tenure of the duchy. Henry saw it as a way of generating a sense of investment in his war aims. Those to whom lands were given were obliged to defend them, much as guarantees in Ireland, Wales and Scotland had been done in earlier generations. The terms of grants often involved service in defence of royal castles, as well as in the royal army, at the guarantee's own expense. The settlement thus gave the king military resources, thereby reducing the burden on English finances. It also gave him substantial means of reward and patronage, suitable for all ranks of the army, ranging from a house in one of the captured towns for an archer, and a whole county with its title for a high-ranking nobleman. In essence, Henry recreated feudalism in Normandy. He used it to supplement the royal rights in France, which he took over by virtue of his claim to the throne, especially the semence des nobles, deploying it not only to call out the native nobility, but also those to whom he had given lands. An essential part of Henry's programme was a financial administration for the duchy through the establishment of a chamber of accounts at Caen. his administrative capital, so that revenues came to him rather than to the French king in Paris. In time, as the conquest was secured, it was envisaged that the Estates of Normandy, an assembly made up of representatives of clergy, nobility and townsmen, could be called and taxation raised in the hope that Henry's duchy could be self-financing. Although a separate chancery enrolment, the Norman Rolls, was initiated for the conquest, Henry was also keen to take over the existing administrative structures of the duchy, such as the administrative subdivisions under the French equivalent of sheriffs. He should appoint trusted Englishmen as bailiffs, but shrewdly ensured that lower-ranking officials, such as the vicomtes, were local men, with local knowledge, who had accepted English rule. In order to implement this impressive political program, Henry first needed a successful military campaign. It began on the 1st of August, 1417. His entire army landed at the mouth of the River Torx in Lower Normandy. As in 1415, Henry initially kept his army together to besiege Caen, but in contrast with his first campaign, he also took care to establish smaller bridgeheads along the coast first. The capture of Caen took only 2 weeks, thanks largely to bombardment and the townspeople's early recognition that further resistance would only be to their disadvantage when there was no chance of a French army relieving the siege. With Caen taken, Henry was able to march directly south, capturing places as he went, thereby cutting Lower Normandy in half. Such quick and impressive success persuaded Parliament, meeting in mid-November 1417, to agree another double lay subsidy. Remarkable generosity, given that they had made a similar award the previous year. As the Chancellor put it, quote, "The King's great merits and illustrious virtues meant that he fully deserved such splendid honours," end quote. By the 24th of November, indeed, probably from the moment of his landing, Henry styled himself Duke of Normandy as well as King of France. His generally conciliatory policy towards his conquered people, supported by strict discipline over his troops, was aimed at encouraging local acceptance. Only where Henry met with resistance did he act harshly. As a result, relatively few Norman knights and gentry chose exile rather than submission. With the fall of Falaise at the turn of the year, Henry was able to divide his army under the command of his brothers, Thomas and Humphrey, so that the areas to the east and west could be taken simultaneously. On the 30th of July, 1418, with Lower Normandy in his hands, he began the siege of Rouen. This was the campaign's most formidable challenge to date, for, as Henry noted in a letter to the City of London on the 10th of August, it was, quote, "the most notable place in France, save Paris," quote. Well aware of the significance of the city militarily and politically, Henry was prepared to use any means to take it without extensive bombardment or assault. But in doing so, he also risked giving the French time to organise a counter-offensive to relieve the city. Determined to starve the city out, he refused to let even women and children leave. The siege of Rouen lasted 6 months, and when, in January 1419, it finally surrendered, the anticipated French relief force, having been scuppered by a renewed outbreak of factional infighting, was the largest city ever to be taken by siege during the whole of the Hundred Years' War. Henry appeared in the robes of the Duke of Normandy in the Norman capital, where he made various edicts in that guise to an assembly of Norman knights and townsmen, and also placed a higher collective ransom on the city. End quote. So this is a massive thing. Henry taking Rouen. A lot has happened there. I mean, I've done quite a bit of reading there, but that was like a couple of years worth of action. But now Henry has taken, he's taken Caen, he's taken Falaise, he's taken Rouen. He has taken basically all of Normandy. He has done the Norman conquest in reverse. You know, Rouen was the capital of Normandy way back when. So this is the reverse of what William the Conqueror did in 1066. Henry V gets them back for it. It's a big deal. And no wonder that going forward here now, as I shall relate momentarily, no wonder the French monarchy has got nothing left. They've been beaten in the field so thoroughly that they can barely raise an army 2 years later. And all their biggest, best cities, certainly in northern France, have been taken. As I mentioned there, Rouen is second only to Paris, really. I mean, there's other important towns and cities in France. I mean, Rennes springs to mind, but that's sort of got more of a symbolic significance rather than, you know, an actual economic one. So, yeah, the fall of Rouen is one of the last straws as far as the French are concerned. There's nothing left in the tank for them now at this stage. Okay, I'll let Anne Curry continue. She says, quote, "With the surrender of Rouen, the rest of Upper Normandy fell with little resistance, save for the island of Mont Saint-Michel, which never fell to the English, Henry was master of the whole duchy, able to implement all the elements of his Norman programme. His 1417 to 1419 campaign was remarkable, testament to his ever-increasing capacity as commander as well as ruler. Normandy would always mean something special to Henry. When he came to a final treaty with the French at Troyes in May 1420, he kept the duchy for himself until such time as he would inherit the French crown. That he had achieved a high level of success in winning the hearts and minds of the Normans is also indicated by the outpouring of grief at his death and the loyalty which they showed to his successors. Key to this was the strict military discipline he imposed, particularly in regulating relations between soldiers and civilians and creating mechanisms for local inhabitants to lodge complaints. He took a notably hard line with camp followers, reflecting his own moral transformation on accession. There is strong evidence that Henry was prepared in the summer of 1419 to agree a diplomatic settlement which would give him Normandy as a completely sovereign possession without any obligation to pay homage to the French crown for it. That summer, his successes prompted approaches from both French factions, the Burgundians and the Armagnacs. In the face of Henry's advance, the French had maintained a united front until the summer of 1418, when the Burgundian John, Duke the Fearless, seized Paris, as well as the King and Queen, forcing the then Dauphin, Charles, to flee south. Divisions then contributed to the failure of the French to intervene to rescue Rouen. Now Henry was keen to negotiate with both sides, the Burgundian-controlled royal government as well as the Armagnac opposition led by the Dauphin, because he saw this as a means of keeping them divided and ruling. His biggest concern was their reconciliation. A united France remained a formidable enemy. Negotiations with the Dauphin came first. At Alençon in October 1418, Henry, as he always had, set his demands higher, now adding Normandy, Touraine and Maine to the land stipulated in the Treaty of Brittany, and even including Flanders as a reward for an alliance against Burgundy. The Dauphin was willing to give him Normandy, which in Henry's view was an empty gesture, since God had already delivered it into his hands. Nonetheless, he was willing to consider a long truce, during which he dropped the title of King of France in return for a large payment. The following month saw negotiations at Pont de l'Arche with the Burgundian-controlled royal government. Henry demanded the Brittany terms plus Normandy in full sovereignty, as well as a dowry of 1 million écus for marriage to Charles VI's daughter Catherine, whose hand in marriage he had requested 4 years earlier. Then he had been rebuffed. Now the situation was rather different. Henry, fully aware of his strong military position, was simply playing with his enemy. The continuing mental illness of Charles VI made it unclear whether anyone in the French camp had the authority to negotiate a settlement. In the words of the chronicler Jean Lefebvre, the French were unable to treat with Henry. The Dauphin is not yet king, and the Duke of Burgundy does not possess the royal inheritance. Quote. While the negotiations stalled over the course of the spring of 1419, Henry strengthened his position in Normandy, conquering places on its northern frontier, which provided a buffer zone, called by the English the Pas de Conquête, against Paris. When, between late May and June, he met again with the Burgundian-controlled government at Moulins, they were prepared to offer the Brittany terms plus Normandy and his dowry demands. I mean, they didn't really have any choice. He could have demanded anything. Well, he kind of was. He's asking for the full shebang, and they can't refuse him. They can't. Significantly, the 18-year-old Catherine was brought to Moulins, where Henry saw her for the first time. Even without injecting a romantic element into Henry's chaste military existence, it was clear that the king was keen to marry, and to marry only Catherine. Indeed, this had been the most consistent element in all of his negotiations from 1413 onwards. The meeting also brought him into direct contact with Charles VI and his queen, Isabeau of Bavaria, for the first time since they had all attended the wedding of Richard II to Catherine's sister, Isabella, near Calais, nearly a quarter of a century before. The negotiations at Moulins are well documented. I mean, there's a big scene in Shakespeare, even to detailing how a special terrain was selected and demarcated by wooden palisades and divided by two trenches into three parts. The French would be located in the area nearest to Moulins and the English in the part farthest away. The middle section would be a neutral zone when the negotiators met. The French, moreover, had a solid fence built around the middle section, high enough to protect against English arrows should things get nasty. This middle section was accessible only by three fenced passages and contained two separate tents at each side, one for each monarch and his counsellors. Exactly 36 feet from each tent and within a further palisade was the pavilion for actual negotiations. Such elaborate arrangements, as well as the double royal presence, highlighted the serious intent of both parties. That Catherine was there too indicates that a betrothal was an anticipated outcome. The fact that the negotiations covered detailed matters, including the restoration of lands and benefices in Normandy to those who supported the Burgundian regime, also suggests that a settlement was in sight. A letter sent home by an Englishman on the 14th of July reported that Henry had been hoping that the French would fulfil their promise, that he and his heirs would have, quote, all that was contained in the great peace of Brittany, the Duchy of Normandy, and all that the king had gotten on the French ground, to hold all these things of God only, and not of none earthly creature, end quote. But then, the writer continued, just when the negotiations were on the brink of being concluded, and treaties drawn up, they had hit a brick wall. Suddenly, the accommodating behaviour of the French changed to obfuscation. In the words of the English writer, quote, the French party hath come in with diverses demands and questions, end quote. As these were fully intended to do, they caused delays, and the atmosphere had accordingly deteriorated. As the writer went on to tell his recipient in England, John the Fearless and the Dauphin had been holding their own convention at Paris in the meantime. The Duke, present for some of the time at Moulins, had been playing a double game, and as the writer explained, quote, they had set them together in rest and in accord, quote. Their arrangement had been proclaimed in Paris on the 11th of July, promising to work together to drive out the English, with orders that no one should henceforth make quarrel because of the name of Burgundian or Armagnac. It was precisely the outcome that Henry did not want. Well, it seems a bit late now, doesn't it, for the Armagnacs and the Burgundians to finally make up, at least for a while again. Henry's already won the big battle, the main decisive battle. He's already occupied all of Normandy. He's at the gates of Paris, essentially. It's a little, too late. Henry kind of holds all the cards militarily and politically. A bit late for all that from John the Fearless. Okay, a couple last paragraphs and then we'll end it for this week. Anne Curry says, despite Henry's strength, as the letter writer had noted, the newly unified French were more interested in war than a negotiated settlement. Henry's hand was forced. Without hesitation, he advanced towards Paris, i.e. with his army. Taking the towns of Pontoise and Gisors, he was at the outskirts of Paris by mid-August, when his brother Thomas, at Henry's order, rode up to the gates of Paris, a dramatic gesture intended to put pressure on the French towards reopening diplomatic channels. Whether Henry could realistically have seized the French capital is doubtful. Rouen had taken him 6 months, and now he had considerably fewer troops with him, having installed garrisons to secure his recent conquests en route to Paris. Furthermore, while the French had been divided during the siege of Rouen, now they threatened unity. But before Henry needed to make up his mind whether to lay siege to Paris, the French tore themselves apart in a way which gave the English king more success in France than he could ever have imagined. On the 10th of September 1419, Duke John and the Dauphin were due to meet on the bridge at the town of Montereau on the Seine, east of Paris, for further discussions on their cooperation. As the Duke moved onto the bridge, one of the Dauphin's henchmen struck him in the face with an axe, killing him instantly. The factional conflict had degenerated into a vendetta. Duke John murdered in revenge for his assassination of Louis, Duke of Orléans, 12 years before. Whether the Dauphin was personally complicit remains uncertain. Only 16, he was presumably easily influenced by those who had previously been in the service of the Duke of Orléans and who had carried out the murder of Duke John at Montreux. Despite their attempted reconciliation in the face of the English threat, quote, the two factions were as far apart as they had ever been. Not without cause did a Carthusian friar, almost exactly a century later, show Francis I, King of France, the skull of John the Fearless, observing, quote, this is the hole through which the English entered France, quote. That hole effectively made Henry V the ruler of France, end quote. So the French, the Armagnacs and the Burgundians just couldn't get their act together. And so it's an ultimate win for Henry V. Something to note of there. I think it was in my first episode, was it? One of the earlier episodes I did about Henry. I mentioned that murder of the Duke of Orléans 12 years previous. Do you remember that? Where he was just riding through Paris late at night and some men set about him and murdered him. And it was the Duke of Burgundy that was behind it. And it was a scandal. All of France was scandalized. And even though he was a very close relation to the king was in a political position. He couldn't do anything about it. And even the Duke of Orleans' own family, own retinue, couldn't really do anything about it at the time. Well, they had been waiting for their moment. And the murder of John the Fearless on the bridge there, 12 years later, they finally got their own back. But it did mean that the King of England, Henry, can just walk straight into Paris now.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Ugh, fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
A t-shirt and jeans. Mac and cheese. Some things in life are an obvious match, like RIAs and Schwab Advisor Services, the number one choice for independent advisors. The difference is so obvious, it's Schwabvious. Learn why at schwabvious.com.